Okay, there, of course, this is done with many people. My closest collaborator will be here next week, and he will give you much more detail than all the technical details. So, but this, there's, I think the whole room are my collaborators, so I run out of place to list more people, but I just listed a few here. Let me see. I can't quite figure out how to use it, but I think maybe this will work. Women. How does it go? Which one? Maybe this one. I don't quite know how to do this, but anyway, I'm pushing all the buttons. It's too high tech for me. Okay. Now, this is probably not the most up to date. It's probably already out of date. Here are something that Catherine put it together. Stefan, you tell me, it's probably already out of date by far. Okay, so there are all these different methods of trying to detect planets. You already heard quite a bit. And one challenge is to see if we can come up with something that can both try to explain this and as well as to make some future predictions that you can test throughout 99% of the models and then gradually home in on something that is give a global characteristics. Planets come in great varieties, and there's to every rule there's a lot of exception. So what do we get out of this is to really attempt to understand some global pattern here. And instead of understanding every rock, we may want to have a look at the continents, where the continents are. Here is a continent, here is a continent. And this is not a control sample, but it gives you some indication that perhaps there is a little, not a uniform distribution. Okay, and it would be great if one can do control samples of observation and compare with theory. Okay, so some key theoretical questions. What physical process determine the mass period distribution, size period distribution? How do, in around any given host star, how do dynamical architecture emerge around mature systems, young systems? How do we, this is sort of like an evolution type of analysis, and eventually when observation enables us to go down to young systems, maybe we can look at evolution here. And one question is why there is no super Earth in the solar system. Okay, so Stefan has already given you the overall picture of population synthesis. The philosophy is put it here, and I don't need to go into any more details. And what we do is very similar to what they do. And basically, you coupled planet formation with the evolution of their host environment, and then try to go forward and see how you can produce what is down here. And the focus right now is two different populations, super Earth and gas giants. And clearly there's a biological justification, but that's just for our grant applications. Okay, so the first generation of population synthesis provided us with some preliminary success. But it also revealed a lot of problems, because this is sort of like building a stellar structure model from the beginning. You put in, as I said here, each one of the step along here is kind of has its sort of qualitative understanding, but quantitatively, the efficiency of a lot of things are not particularly well constrained yet. Okay, for example, that we don't know how fast this disk go away, and how does this gaseousness evolve in time, what causes transport of angular momentum redistribution of material, how do heavy elements condense out to form planetesimals, and how do they get retained and along the way. And perhaps the greatest revolution in this, the conceptual revolution on the theory of planet formation, has been the realization that planets are not born where you see them in the end. Okay, so they have great mobilities, they move around, and so if we were to summarize theory of planet formation of the last 20 years in one word, it's migration. Okay, and migration, of course, leads to diversity and leads to other things, but it also poses challenges, not only of relocating them, but poses challenges of how to retain them. And the detail of that retention and how to build them up on time scale, that's before the gas goes away to build gas giants. And all of these are the challenges that at every level. Okay, and there we can provide some theoretical scenarios that will be tested by lots and lots of observations. And so the observation provides the calibration and hints where the interesting process may lie.
In this models, by what measurements did you start your evolution?
At which point?
Yes.
At which point? Yeah. At the moment, we start from T-Tauri phase, mm-hmm. but in principle, you should go earlier.
So
okay. No, you start with planetesimals. But how do you get to the, in principle, you should go also earlier. And actually, we do address some of the issues concerning dusts. I'll describe this in a minute, okay? And so these are all important issues that one should not take, I cannot help but to be philosophical at my age. There's an Eastern approach and a Western approach, okay? The Eastern approach is holistic, that you want to think of all of the link between everything, okay? But that is a great barrier towards understanding of science. And the success of science in the West is this analytical approach, where you can actually separate a problem, one problem at a time, and everything else, you put it either as initial condition or boundary condition. Okay, and that has been great because then we can go into details understanding each process and only at the end put everything together. So a lot of these things were not yet there. Okay, so this is sort of, it's a story of stellar evolution. You can understand the evolution towards giant phase without understanding star formation. Same. Okay, so here are some success. One is that we can kind of reproduce the distribution of gas giants. Okay, the mass period distribution of gas giants. There's some correlation with the stellar mass, the frequency of stars which has gas giants seems to be an increasing function of the stellar mass, an increasing function of metallicity, and so on and so forth. Okay, but the problem is that in the first attempts, we really did not understand anything that's going on here, and mostly what's going on here, okay? And we just had these migrations, and we get arbitrarily terminate them somewhere near here, and we arbitrarily choose coefficients to characterize the efficiency of migration, okay? So, and all of these calculations are also done with one planet per system at a time. So their mutual interaction has not been taken into account. So that's why in the early papers that none of this has eccentricity distribution, none of them have multiple systems, but it produced nonetheless some of these success around this region. And that's probably because that to form long period gas giants, the condition that's required to form them is pretty robust. And we have probably got that one more or less right. And Now, so what characterizes this distribution? Okay, what characterizes this hole? Why is there a hole in the mass period distribution? Okay, that's because these are low mass objects. They coagulate and they build up into larger and larger cores, but they need to get to several Earth masses before they can accrete gas efficiently. And the reason for that is because then when they start to accrete gas, and the gas as well as planetesimals release some energy, and that energy chokes unless it can be efficiently redistributed, then it start to be deposited near this core. So the pressure builds up, and then pressure goes against gravity. So instead of having a bumpy solution of accretion onto a whole sinkhole, what you have is that in fact you have a sediment solution, sort of things are gradually contracting slowly as the radiation can leak out. Okay, so that's what hangs up around here, and you get hung up for quite some distance, but exactly where you start to undergo gas accretion, it's still poorly understood. Okay, and here's the observation of super-Earths. It's very important. Once you start to undergo gas accretion, it is kind of like a runaway. Once you get into this phase that Aizio talked about, that the radiation is no longer hung up, okay? Then the more you accrete, the larger the gravitational cross-section, the faster you accrete and you go, until you start to influence your environment. At that point, you stall. And that's probably what determines this lower boundary. Okay, so that's kind of fairly well understood. And because this is a very fast process, and much faster than the gas depletion time scale, and you're either here or you go through this runaway, you get to there. Okay, but there's also some migration that pushes things that way, and that is caused because the interaction with the background disk, and then these idealized solutions, we just store them with a bucket here, just catch anything that comes in. We don't do anything along the way, okay? So, but nonetheless, we think that this region is probably okay. There's some migration over here, but the detail here is not good. Okay, so. Yeah, and that you have also an observational constraint from the depletion of the decline of the signature, of this signature, you have a constraint there, okay? So, and that again is a theoretical pursuit. How do you explain that observational constraint? Okay, so along each step, you need to do this. Yeah. I mean, we put those things in. Okay, well, that's the reason. This, you know, if you have infinite time to wait, if the gas is around there all the time, and then you will start to eat into this part. Okay, because this part, this boundary, is actually exactly to address the question you ask, because it takes at larger radius, it takes longer time for these cores to build up to be bigger, and so as a result. And you need time to become, to go over to this threshold for gas accretion to start. And if the gas goes away, then you get stuck here. And that's what this boundary is about. Okay? So this is really very, very interesting diagram. And then this is also interesting because this gradual fading here tells you some of these guys, when they migrate, the gas goes away on timescale comparable to their migration timescale. So that tells you that some of them get stuck here. Okay. So if you know this period distribution, you know something about the competition between migration and evaporation, you know something about here, you know a little bit about what it takes to build up the critical mass core compared to the evaporation time. You know this, you know something about the onset of gas accretion, you know something about this, you know about the termination, okay? And of course, all of the planet-star interaction you will get out of here. And that is not included in these previous models. Okay, so while we're doing that, we must keep in mind initial condition, initial condition, initial condition. Okay, now we leave behind heavy elements. I'm a true believer of core accretion scenario. Okay, and if people want to waste their time to follow Alan Boss, and I suggest you leave here now. And I'm glad somebody else is wasting their time, but that's okay. It's not my worry. Okay, so if we believe in core accretion scenario, that means you first need to build up the core. You need to have the heavy elements condense out to build into these little objects. Okay, and then the object will grow in time. So of course, the more heavy element you leave behind in the disk, the better you are at, with a better chance of building up gas giants. Okay, and also super Earths. Now, so why don't we just have 10 times minimum mass nebula? What is minimum mass nebula? You take all the heavy element in the solar system today that you get left behind, and you put it, spread it out. That's minimum mass nebula. So, but that assumes there's 100% efficiency. What if planet building process has only got 10% efficiency? We start with 10 times more mass than there is. But then that's talking about 20% of the total amount of metals that's inside the star, okay? So whatever you leave behind, it doesn't go into the star. So if you leave behind this much material, the star will get a little less than before. So this is a concern, okay? But how do you know how much metallicity you start out with? It's very difficult because anything can start out with any amount. We don't know the initial conditions. We can't determine metallicity around star-forming clouds. What we can do is to look around these young clusters. We make comparison of very similar type of stars, solar type of stars. We look at them element by element, their dispersion, okay? For example, this is around Pleiades. If you look at lithium, the lithium has a factor of 3 spread all around. That's because lithium is being depleted during this early phase, the first 100 million years as they form. But what is really remarkable is to the observational accuracy, and some people can dispute whether this is really 20 sigma or just, you know, and that error bar is disputable, but down to this level, you can now start to get very high accuracy spectra. And you can make comparison. You can just put them side by side. And you can see that the metallicity spread, which is surprisingly small, because anything you can think of will introduce a metallicity difference between this guy and that guy and that guy and that guy. The fact that this is that small, it tells you the amount of heavy element you left behind in this disk could not be more than twice minimum mass nebula. So that efficiency. It's hard. It's very, very hard. And the reason, yes. We did one more cluster. But it's very hard because you need very high quality spectra. And if you go to any lower than their fast spin and the active chromosphere, it's very difficult. But if you go to clusters of this kind of age, and you can go through more heavy rich, you know, more elemental systems with more metallicity, you can do that. And I'm hoping very much, Stefan, with your help, that perhaps into clusters which contains a few F stars, okay, because that constraint. Yeah, it's about 100 million years old. But all of the action is already done here, okay? But the reason I prefer to go to clusters with some earlier type of stars, which is very difficult because they're fast rotators, is because their convection zone is much thinner, okay? While this assumes the total amount of heavy elements that you left behind is twice minimum mass nebula. But what if you think that there are all these late heavy bombardments onto the surface of the star? Okay? Now, since if this is really happening in Pleiades, and that for these type of stars, it happened after 30 million years, after the solar type stars already got onto Zaan, so you can calculate the total amount of pollution to the envelope it happened, 6 Earth masses. If you go to earlier type stars, you can get down to fraction of Earth's mass, and you can ask, how is the whole star influenced by the residual bombardment of residual planetesimals? Okay? So this puts in the boundary condition, it's sort of the initial condition, that we cannot arbitrarily just push up with arbitrarily large amount of minimum mass nebula. Now, Ed Thomas will tell you that is difficult because, you know, there's all of these constraints about how to build up large cores, okay? And H0 had done enormous amount of work in this context, and to build up something that is 10 times Earth's mass, you need a lot of material here, and so they can overcome what is called dynamical isolation. I'll come back to that in a few minutes. Okay, now, in that context, we need to have a lot of material, a lot of surface density, but you don't need to have it like minimum mass nebula as a simple power law. If you have locations where you can actually concentrate all your building block material, then you can form them as special locations. Now, if you look at the moisture, the humidity of Earth's atmosphere, you would think that the Earth would never rain when you average out over the entire globe. But there are places it rains, and rains heavily, especially from Seattle, okay? Especially from one side of Mauna Kea, okay? So there are regions where you concentrate them, you get precipitation, and that location of concentration could be a barrier if you could have some kind of barrier. This go back to the stage earlier than what you were mentioning, and if you had grains, can we have grains instead of grain migrating all the way to the host star, can we have them migrating and get stored near some special location such as the ice line? That is determined by the condition whether, how do they migrate? They migrate because the gas in this disk is rotating mostly at subcapillary rate. And there's a pressure gradient, it's hot in here, cold in there, so that counteracts against gravity. So this thing rotates a little slower, so the grains sees a headwind and they want to move in, okay? But if you have regions where there's a local maximum in pressure, okay, then in fact, the pressure gradient acts together with gravity, in fact, causes you to have a supercapillary rotation. So instead of having a headwind, you have a tailwind, and you go outwards. And there are these locations at the ice line. The reason for that is a little involved, and this is to do with, in order to get a surface density maxima, you need to understand angular momentum transfer mechanism, okay, in this disk. That needs to be understood in terms of viscosity. To understand viscosity is hard, because we don't really have a clue exactly what drives viscosity. But there is one model. The model is MRI. Now, the problem with MRI is that MRI with magnetic turbulence, you can drive a lot of angular momentum transport. But that still requires the coupling between the magnetic field with the fluid. Now, in this part of the disk, it's so cold, only a few hundred degrees, down to 100 degrees, and it's very few, you know, free electron around. Even if the magnetic field is turbulent, but it's not going to influence neutral stuff here. Okay, so how do you get it influenced? And usually you require some electron, and the electron is concentrated near the surface because there are UV radiation from here, cosmic ray from out here, and that photoionizes or collisionally ionizes these electrons. But the electron fraction is determined by recombination, a balance between ionization and recombination. That occurs primarily on the surface of grains. The more grains you have, the higher, the lower the ionization fraction, and therefore you tend to have a lower viscosity, okay, effective angular momentum transport. And so this is the region outside the snow line, but inside there, all of these ice grains are gone. Okay, we're gonna do an experiment on this in about a few days. And when that is gone, and then of course, then the ionization fraction becomes much higher, so it becomes more viscous, so the density is lower, and you get this maxima, and that's where you can get hung up. And probably it's by no accident, when you look at the period distribution, all the gas giants seem to cluster around one or two, or two or three AU, and that's because of this preferred process. Okay, there's this snow line region, and that something happens there. Okay, this you already heard from Catherine, so I won't go into much more detail. It's basically this is Catherine's thesis work, and try to understand all of what the disk structure. So this sort of, you link planet formation with protostellar disk, star formation, and the big latest theory of accretion disks. But of course, there's a certain lot of uncertainties here. But let's just move along with that, okay? So the next stage, as I said, these are classic work by Kukubu and Ida. And if we look at, you know, the surface of the moon, surface of asteroid, there's no question they were built up from collisional coagulation. So I'm not going to worry about all of the fragments that collide and what is a critical condition. They will break up or they'll build up to bigger and bigger objects, okay? And that, of course, is an important issue, but that's not the qualitative issue, it's a quantitative issue. Okay, suppose we understand that, and then we are able to build up things, and then you have this interesting effect of emergence, what is, they call it oligarchs, and basically what happens is that you start to accrete in the presence, in some sense, in the presence of gas, and then the eccentricity of these guys are not, they're damped to some extent, they're also damped by the background planetesimals. And as a result, you find that their sphere of influence is limited to only about 5 Hill radius each way. And if you pick up all of the material inside that feeding zone, you get what is called an isolation mass. The isolation mass is clearly dependent on surface density to 3½ power. And so in regions where you concentrate this, you get larger isolation mass. Okay, so, and then further out you go, and the isolation mass gets bigger, but it takes longer to grow. So this is a competition, you know, if you're too close to Washington, you have all these restrictions, you can't become very big. Here out in the far west, we can grow to arbitrarily big, but we don't have funds to grow for these companies, so they are starved here. Okay, so that's that, okay? So after they grow, and as I said, they undergo migration, and the reason for, you know, there are many, many people have worked on many different type of migration. There are more type of migration than migration itself, type 1, 2, 3, 4, and 7, and all that. But anyway, so the upshot is the most devastating migration is the one that is sort of type 1 migration, the one that when these planetesimals, embryos, are still sufficiently small that they don't strongly perturb the disk, okay? And the problem is that they exert the torque and then they exchange angular momentum with both the inside and the outside. But the outside has a slightly stronger influence on the inside. There's general tendency for them to spiral in. Okay, now the trouble is that the spiral in time scale is very, very fast. So you may not be able to get to the 10 Earth mass core before you're gone. Okay, and so you can't really form planets and all of that. Okay, but there's also another type of migration. It's you manage to form gas giants and then they open up a gap and you evolve with the viscous evolution of the disk. But then, of course, there's also these type of combination of planetesimal and gas and all that. I won't go into all of the names. So my apologies if your name is not on there, because it takes too much effort for me to chase down all the names. And also, the only, as I said before, in Cambridge, the only name that I put down there are people over the hill. So and if your name are not mentioned, then that means you still have a bright future ahead of you. So and okay. So I hope my good friend Peter and Scott are not listening. So anyway, there's this type 1 migration, and the effect has been thoroughly calculated by the pioneering work of Gouraud, Tremaine, and Ward, and all that. Okay, so basically you get this negative inward migration, things move too fast. Of course, this was later on checked by Frederic Macet, and also by most recently, by Bertheau, Clément Bertheau, and among other people. So let's not worry about the thermodynamic effect. Just look at these effects of surface density distribution in locally isothermal systems. And what you find is that in addition to these, what is called Lindblad torque, which are the streamlines which are sort of freely flowing, there are also streamlines that goes back and forth like this. You're connecting all these streamlines, okay? Now, these streamlines, when you first connect them, when you first get them connected, okay, and they can introduce a large torque, which is called co-rotation torque, and that co-rotation torque could be very large, and it could be outwards. So, but the problem is that these streamlines goes out here and comes back, and it goes back out here and comes back in again. So this, there's lots of mixing, okay? There's a lot of mixing here. And so that effect of co-rotation gets damped out. Okay, so this is one of the things that we talked about earlier, whether you can do things with just a local sharing box, or you try to understand this type of effect on the long term. And that little bit of change can cause angular momentum flow dramatically near here. Okay, so of course, there's also the possibility of gas flow right around here. Now that gas flow right around here, you can smear things out because you can have resupply material. So if you can resupply material, then you can keep this co-rotation torque up for a while, okay? But as long as there is a pressure gradient, as long as there's some kind of local maxima in the scale height, you can actually, there's a rise and a decline of the scale height, and as long as there's that, you can go outwards. But if it's monotonically decreasing, you still go inwards. Okay? So for that reason, Frederic did this calculation with it's a donut with a hole in the middle, and a migrating a gas giant tried to go to the edge of the donut. He did all the simulation. He sees, lo and behold, they come down and they get stuck near the edge of the donut. Okay, so that's probably fairly well understood, and independent of the mass, they can get all of this. So you put that in. Okay, you can ask, where are these special locations? There are several locations that you could do it. One location is this area where you can have these magnetospheric disk cavity, and then there's another area where you can have ionization fraction change and a boundary between dead zone and active zone, and you can calculate where these things would be. Okay. And the problem is that all of these locations are also changing with time, and they depend. There's a lot of reasons for diversity. There, you can change mass accretion rate, the stellar dipole field, and Catherine has already talked about that. Okay, so this is, I just briefly mentioned what Catherine has done, is to do this disk profile as a function of time. Here is the distribution, so she can plot out the surface density variations to define locations where migration would crystal. Okay. So there, but as you can see, as disks evolve in time, these special locations evolve like that. So if you really want to understand the final resting place of super Earths, one needs to understand this, because super Earths, if they can get caught into this migration, maybe they can get caught onto here and then move along here, and the final resting place would depend on this.
The inner curve is the magnetosphere.
This is magnetosphere. Okay, that increases because the accretion rate goes down. The magnetic field can push things out. Okay, and this is the boundary between the two. No, well, let me show you. There's very good question. You anticipated that. Clearly, there's an expert here. So for people who are not expert, here is a planet. Okay, this is just one idealized case. Okay. And you get into this, migrate and caught onto this. And this, in time, this is a very short time that you get caught. And then you move along here, and then this thing is starting to go out, and you can go out from here, okay? So now the problem is, okay, so I will tell you there's a lot of diversity here in a few minutes. Okay, so you can caught, this is just one idealized system. Of course, when you get down to this low event stage, the density of the disk is so low, even if when this move out, you may not move out. Okay. And then there are other effects, which I briefly mentioned, the interaction with a strong magnetic field of the whole star, and introducing unipolar induction, and we're just starting to put those type of effect in. And if you're inside, in general, if you're inside the co-rotation radius, you get pulled in. If you're outside co-rotation radius, you get pushed out. You may think that if these hot Earths, super Earths, get parked near the inner edge of this magnetospheric cavity, they tend to get pulled in. But in fact, that during later stages, as the star may not necessarily be in synchronous rotation with the inner boundary of these magnetospheric cavities, okay, the outer boundary. So it's possible for the star to actually exert the torque to make some of these super Earths to go up a bit. Okay. So we can put this kind of thing in, but it's not essential. One of the other problem is, this is something we also discussed the other day with Carolyn's paper with John, and this is the paper by Jilin, and where you can actually have migration get stalled. The first one gets stalled, somebody else comes along, gets pushed in a little bit more, and then you can get a stock of several sort of things here. And now there, we're still don't really understand this very well. And exactly whether, if you get stuck on the first one, whether that could hold back everybody else. And there's some indication from Shigeru Ida's calculation that maybe you just stall one, you can hold back everybody else. But there is also some indication they may be able to go through. So if they manage to go through to form these resonance systems, then the tidal effect afterwards will destroy that resonance. And here it successfully produced this this system. Okay. The influence. I said I'm not going to talk much about gas giant formation because I think it's pretty robust, and a lot of work has already been done here. And this is also an area that Ichiro has just talked about. So I won't go into any of the detail. But the only thing I want to mention is that there are phases of mass growth. Initially, it's relatively slow, but in the end, when it starts to accrete just before gap formation, it could be relatively fast. If it is relatively fast, it can influence the disk region in planetesimals out here. When it's very slow, it tends to open up this kind of gap. Okay, the planetesimal gap because you tend to excite their eccentricity after they get damped. They tend to move away from the growing protoplanet. But if it happens in the very, very end, they're growing so fast, then as the Hills radius expand quickly on time scale, only a few hundred years, tens of orbits, which is actually short compared to the libration timescale and synodic timescale. So these guys nearby can actually get destabilized, orbit gets destabilized. So some of it gets scattered out, some of it gets scattered in, some of it actually collide with the envelope of gas giants. And that is interesting because if we use the core accretion scenario, we build the core, and then accrete gas, and the gas is depleted of heavy elements. So in principle, you would imagine that by inference, that gas giants should have very poor metallicity in their envelope, but that's not the case. Jupiter and Saturn, they all have super solar metallicity. So one way to do that is to have this giant impact at later stage to give you this pollution in the atmosphere. So that's interesting. But the emergence of gas giant also influence the planetesimals around here, and most of this influence is through just gentle secular perturbation, but every now and then you can get into secular resonance. Makiko has done, and Ed Thomas has done all this, and when you get this secular resonance in here, you can greatly excite the eccentricity here. You get things to build up, and then they collide, and then there's still a little bit of residual gas left to get them into a low eccentricity orbit. And this is probably an important process in the formation of our Earth. Okay, so, but then this is something that Ichiro and I are looking at, I'm sure other people are looking at. The formation of gas giant, the first gas giant, may seem to be very marginal. That's why only 15% gets formed. But my understanding, maybe this is completely wrong understanding, is that whenever you see the first one, the probability of seeing the next one and the next one is high. So the either, you know, it's like these family census. Either they have no children or they have two or three more children, right? So their multiple system is very common amongst those stars which has planets. So if you are so difficult in forming the first one, how about forming the second one, the third one, the fourth one? And people often said that it's impossible to form, and that's why there are these people who claim about jumping Jupiters and blah, 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 and because they want to form much closer to Jupiter and then chuck them out. But it turns out that it's difficult. But one way you can do it is to promote the formation of the next one by opening up a gap, and then here again you get a barrier, you have material that comes through here, and then you build up the subsequent one, and this is known as sequential accretion, not chain accretion. It's an inside joke. Yeah, you can form next the core of the next gas. Yeah.
If we look at the results for Hydrogen,
yes.
There are many of them.
Right.
And not many of them have companions.
Companions, okay. So this may be, that's also a challenge we have to address at some point, okay? So that's certainly a very interesting thing as I'm still struggling with. Clearly, one way is to have dynamical instability, another way, perhaps there's some other method to do it. Okay. So this sort of opens up the possibility of forming things like this without gravitational instability. And Ed Thomas will have another twist to this. Okay. So here it comes to the issue of really understanding that if you did have multiple systems, so far all of these population systems is one planet at a time. How do you do multiple systems? And that turns out to be challenging. You either do it by n-body simulation, but then that is very time consuming. And the idea of all this population synthesis is to generate large amount of these models and then work out statistics. Okay, so one way to do that, to understand this multiple system, is actually try to understand just how this these system may work individually. So, so if the in the absence of gas, then these multiple systems, they perturb each other through secular perturbation, and their eccentricity can grow even after the oligarchic stage. The oligarchic stage is not stage. And the only reason there's a transition is because oligarchic stage is able to attain the oligarchic stage in the presence of gas. The gas damped down its eccentricity, and so you get a balance. Okay, so here is a description of this. This is the log of separation in term of the Hills radius. Okay, so here is factor 10, and here is factor, you know, whatever. Okay, so if you don't have gas, okay, you can calculate the time crossing time as a function of these, you know, you do a large number of n-body simulations. You can see there is a well-defined correlation. You can actually work it out also from first principles, work out in terms of secular perturbation theory. And then if you put in some gas damping, you see immediately for, it doesn't matter very much for these very close pairs of, or triples or quadruple teams of planetesimals. And the gas damping doesn't do anything for them anyway because the perturbation is so strong, so you don't do anything to them. But in this intermediate range, in the, these guys, it's not interesting because their time scale is so long anyway, so you don't care whether the gas is there or not. The gas is already gone by the time they start to get excited. So that's not interesting. But this intermediate stage is really quite interesting at about 10 Hills radius. As you decrease the gas content, you see, if you have a small amount of gas, immediately the crossing time can jump by 3 or 4 orders of magnitude, okay? So in the presence of gas, you get into this stage, so that's why you get dynamical isolation. When the gas goes away, and then of course this will come down here again, and then they resume that perturbation, and they resume growth of eccentricity, and they resume the probability of orbit crossing and accretion. Okay, so putting those formulas into account, we can, you know, with this, I hope there's a truth, there's a grain of sand in here that provides, yes. Anyway, I had to pull this one in somewhere, you know. And, so you can then do this type of semi-analytic prescription to understand how things would, the eccentricity will grow, or they will cross, and they will emerge and form these objects. And we compare with the type of numerical simulation with what Ichiro has so carefully compiled. And the blue, I think, maybe the blue is the simulation, the red is the analytic formula, and I can't tell, maybe it's the other way around. But anyway, here is the eccentricity versus mass, and the and then the semi-major axis versus with the same initial conditions, try to do his experiment. And we can reproduce most of that. With, yes, this is important. Okay, this is very significant in the first set of models we're just starting to generate. Okay, so I'll tell you about those first set of models right here. Okay, so now the first set of models is that we're going to go with this idea that if the first one gets stalled near the magnetospheric cavity, okay, and then the next lot can get all piled up, hanging behind. So there's a population of these guys, okay? And they all concentrate near here. And then So there is a large convoy of planetesimals all get here, and then each one of them only have mass that is a little bit more, somewhere between the lunar size and Earth size, okay? Because they can migrate. Of course, that depends on the efficiency of migration, but we choose one that is reasonable. So they all get accumulated near here, and they're next door to each other, but they are stable because the presence of gas there, and they're relatively small, so their Hilbert radius is small. There's enough elbow room for them to, you know, remain as oligarchs, okay? But the emperor strikes back. Okay, when the gas is pulled away and the hot air is gone, and so then they start to juggle and then start to collide and emerge. Okay, so this solves a couple of very important challenges to this. Super Earths, some of them that's discovered by Stefan, that have masses larger than 10 Earth mass. Why didn't they participate in this gas accretion phase? If they were in this, they move to that location, we can move them to that location, okay, in the presence of gas. But if we move to that location, why haven't they got a big envelope? Why don't they just turn into a hot Jupiter? Okay, now the problem they don't turn into a hot Jupiter is because while there's gas, you don't let them. You let them keep their identity. But when you pull away the gas, they can start to make bigger objects through giant impact, but the gas is gone. So they never become big, okay? So this is called born again embryos. Okay, these born again embryos, they don't have to have resonance because there's a lot of collision. They were near resonance, but this agitation caused them to all hell break loose. So they start to form these objects. And you can see that you can form a population. There's quite a few of them. That depends on the initial condition of how many you can supply over there. Okay, the initial condition is minimum mass. You get a little less, more elbow room. But, you know, with higher mass, you get something like this. But if I don't hold back with a cavity, they all go in there. We don't form these very short period systems. Okay? So again, you know, you should ask Shigeru about all of the details. This is just the first set of simulations.
It's slightly different in the sense that you divide this idea of the electricity of the scattering, as you decrease the masses in the scattering experiment, the probability of things colliding before they eject goes up. So you
right.
Guess that super Earths distribution of eccentricities might be smaller.
Yes.
Just because you have planet collisions and instead of planet projections.
And furthermore, they're much closer to their host star. So that's right. And all of that is noted in terms of plotting eccentricity and with kind of thing like that. Okay? So we actually now start to produce eccentricity as one of the additional diagnostics. So there's, in these systems, this set, there's no gas giant yet, okay? The influence of gas giant is not here yet, okay? So that secular effect that, the beautiful secular effect that Makiko and Ed has done, it's not included here.
If you go from Earth or 400 Earth types of objects to 10 Earth masses, people look dynamical, learn, interact.
Yes. Depends on where you are. Depends on whether you are near this region or out here. Okay.
The close-in,
it's so the value that we get is about 0.1 or thereabout, 0.1 or 0.2. But there are other effects that can come in to cause the eccentricity. As I said, the secular effect from these gas giants and other things. Okay, we can do that later. At the moment, just from this first set of simulation, we get somewhere around 0.1 or so.
In fact, just from the scattering, there should be some sort of critical curve in mass period.
Yes.
Well, at some point, you would start to eject.
Right. So a very, very simple, rule of thumb, okay, is the eccentricity is escape velocity divided by the capillary velocity, okay? That's a very simple rule of thumb. Yeah, but it's a little bit, probably a little bit smaller, because a lot of these collisions are very dissipative and all of that, okay? So, yes. Oh, sorry, I gave up. So here is a case where we did things that has multiple systems, gas giants. Some of these dots are gas giants with super Earths. Some of them are not. Some of them are ice. Some of them are rocks. Okay, so we can look at large amount of rocks here, and then also the issue of after collisions whether all of the volatiles will be gone. Okay, so you can do this with comparing observation. The best set that we can find with best control sample is probably Kepler, and then try to do this with size period distribution versus mass period distribution. And there's a lot of possible diversities. I only mentioned one set that gets stuck and then get born again, but there's also catch and release, and you get things get caught and fail course at ice line, and then they move in. So there are things. And then you can rule out some theories. There's one set of theory that tells you that maybe that the migration is also modified by entropy gradient. And if you do that, you find that this entire region could be emptied out, and then you can compare with observation. And not every model is successful.
So in this case, you move everything out.
Well, basically, what happens is you move out first, and then you move in. And so. So, you know, there are lots of possibilities. Okay, so conclusion, outstanding issue. Everything is up for grabs. Thank you. Thank you.
More questions?
When do we have lunch?
I have a question about the pollution.
Yeah.
The sun provides good evidence that there is large-scale mixing in the vegetative zone.
Yep.
So to what extent all the arguments that you're thinking about pollution rely on just on mixing the convection could be wrong?
Yeah. It's almost entire. It's not only is very probable, but it's highly likely. Okay. And so there are some Pascal is looking into some aspect of this, Pascal Gorod. And but there is actually a very interesting thing that we are currently trying to do, and with one of the students, Chinese students, that I had. And what we do is we look at some of these systems, one particular system where they had actually obtained the stellar oscillation, lots of data from stellar oscillation, so they can see the big split, okay, and the split of the oscillation frequency. So from that you can determine very accurately to 1% level the average density, the mass over radius cube. Okay, so if you have the luminosity and temperature, then you can see for that system you can work out exactly, this thing is slightly off the main sequence, so you can work out exactly what the internal metallicity has to be in order to get to this location of the color magnitude diagram with this mass. And you compare that internal metallicity with the surface metallicity, and then you can get some extent. And this happened to be an F star as well. So the possibility, not F star, it's 1.35 solar mass star. So even though it's on the subgiant, it's starting to move into the subgiant, the convection zone is still very shallow. So you can actually try to milk something out, okay? So far, it's there's no evidence of pollution. But that's an interesting attempt anyway, an attempt towards looking at these things. And I think eventually, with all of the data from the transit data, Kepler data, you know, or plateau data, and then we can get all of these kind of interesting information. Yes.
About the radio segment. What are you putting in?
Yeah, well, yeah, so as I said, when I look at these simulations, right? So if we do the simulations today, we now have where the composition. Okay, we now have all of the composition. We have, you know, whether they're formed here, formed there, okay. And now, so we can just basically either use one or five or whatever, you know, from that. So we can choose this from these ones and then the other ones. It's actually, in general, quite difficult to retain volatiles. When you see a few system that has volatile, that is a true indication of failed cores. Okay, and but because if you have this born again embryos, and then the collision is sufficiently high, there are two things happens. One is that the volatile will probably come off. The second thing is that you will have eccentricity, and the eccentricity gets damped, so there is a lot of heating goes inside that differentiates very quickly, and if you have refractories, you may actually build up the steam in the envelope, and you blow the top. Okay, and that's a possibility that we're investigating on that, and but so to have, you know, if you see a few. Yeah, this is very important.
On your next slide, they seem to be all in the same area.
Yeah, they seem to be, because that is, this is the known system. So we really are concentrating, we should be looking for things down here, okay? So this is the known system now. And there hasn't been, you know, there's only about three or four system down here. This is with Kepler, okay? It was a Kepler capability that we fold in, the detectability and then all of this. So that's what we would expect, okay? And this is the contour we would expect out of Kepler. So if you start to see populations here, because even though we can predict a lot of things down here, but the capability of detecting them is very low. So when you fold it in, this is the contour, okay? So, and one set will be, you know, then you can differentiate the two lot. I think there's one more slide that has that information maybe in it. I didn't put it up. But the other point is that to have the ice super Earth is very important, because it tells you also it's a very strong discriminant. When do you start to launch this runaway gas accretion, okay? Because it's failed core, okay? So where is that, this other thing you can build up later?
Could it be non-failed core that then got evaporated?
Yeah, it could be, but that's a rock, right? I see what you're saying. But then if that's the case, I think, I don't know the answer to that, because I don't know whether the volatile would join the envelope if you do this process. I don't know the answer.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.